You're listening to 2012 and Beyond on WSLR Radio 96.5 LPFM and also streaming live at WSLR.org. My name is Emily, and tonight I'm continuing on with this second part of an interview I did recently with Andrew Bisaggio, who was involved in a government project called Project Pegasus, which involved teleportation and time travel. So we're going to go back to listening to Andrew talking about that. Andy, I just want to ask you, just slightly off track of that, how do you feel about the idea that throughout perhaps the history of our civilization and life on the planet, or for certainly a long period of time, there's been a sort of bloodline Illuminati running the show and controlling and guiding us down this very destructive path, and that that could, at this point, lead us into a science fiction nightmare and a new world order where the technology is just controlling us?
Well, I think that I choose to view the so-called Illuminati merely as powerful, wealthy, oligarchical families and individuals who don't have the best interests of the human race in mind because, for example, they want to continue to profit from weapons production or from the trafficking in metals or drugs or dangerous pharmaceuticals or petrochemicals. So my conception of the Illuminati is not a set of occult bloodlines, although obviously such bloodlines may also exist, but really anybody whose values and actions are inimical to the best interests of the human species and to the rest of the cosmos. And so I kind of conceptualize this as a battle between good and evil that goes on not only on the macro level of the organization of societies and the role that powerful individuals and dynastic families and bloodlines play, but also the battle that goes on in the heart of every individual human being. I mean, are we going to choose, as Buckminster Fuller articulated it, utopia rather than oblivion? Now, in this vein, clearly, I'm being a planetary whistleblower around these technologies, not just to talk about the necessity to explore whether we should implement teleportation as possibly the most significant environmental issue of the 21st century and the need to obviate the emissions that conventional transportation modalities are causing. But also I'm blowing the whistle because of the threat posed by chronovision. You know, it was under President George W. Bush that Admiral John Poindexter was asked to direct a new project under DARPA, the very organization that launched Project Pegasus in the late 1960s, to develop this time travel capability and this remote viewing capability for the U.S. Intelligence community, and has kept it secret for 40 years, that Poindexter was asked to direct a special program under DARPA called Total Information Awareness. And when you consider the fact that the chronovisors that were available by 1970 were already being used to map the past and the future. For example, I was shown past images of things like the signing of the U.S. Constitution in Philadelphia in 1787 and could literally see on the screen of that device George Washington and Benjamin Franklin and the rest of the framers as they looked in life. But I also saw about a 20-minute film loop of one of the planes hitting one of the Twin Towers on September 11th of 2001, some 30 years in the future. So the world public needs to understand that the United States government, that is to say the secret permanent government of the United States, has been in possession of a quantum access capability since around the 1970s. And that capability involves the capacity to gather non-local images of past and future events. So in other words, the domestic spying potential of the governments in possession of this technology goes far beyond just having a surveillance camera on your local street corner in London or some other city where the domestic civilian population is being spied on by its own government. It involves technology that the United States and possibly other world governments now have, where they can literally find out what's going to go on in that street corner 5 years from now.
Okay. Now, do we have the ability to change that before it occurs through free will?
Well, I'm just describing the negative capability of chronovision. I mean, obviously the positive one would be to create museums and libraries were inspiring scenes from the past that were, that couldn't be filmed because they occurred too long ago, could be shown to visitors to the museum or library, including, for example, school children who could be inspired by, you know, great, illustrious scenes from the past. So there's a great sort of catalytic of positive effect on our world civilization that could occur if we used chronovision to sort of map inspiring moments in the past. But the negative capability is that, you know, it's this capability that DARPA has had for 40 years to get a scene of an event that's not occurring right in front of the camera, but that occurred in the past or will occur in the future. If we don't make these technologies public, if the public doesn't learn this, the public is going to be more vulnerable to losing its freedoms, to have its civil rights, to live life as individuals would choose to live life in, under ordered liberty, under an ethos of freedom and democracy, stolen from it possibly, taken from it by a tyrannical, oppressive government in possession of such technology. I'm concerned, both as a lawyer and a humanitarian, that a police state is already being brought down around the people of the so-called free world. I mean, we can't get on an airplane now without practically undressing. And you look at, for example, what's going on in England. The people of Britain are being surveilled all over the place. There are hundreds of thousands of surveillance cameras now in Britain. And this is probably a program that will be taken to all other developed countries. So I'm concerned that a police state is emerging. And because a police state is emerging against the backdrop of the U.S. government being in possession of these quantum access capabilities for 40 years, I am sounding an alarm, not just blowing the whistle. I'm sounding an alarm that the public needs to know that we need to re-democratize our governments, because our governments are in possession of technology that can subject us to a thoroughgoing form of oppression. And we have to put the right people in government. We have to launch truth and amnesty programs for people in the who have served in the military and the intelligence community, as I have, to step forward and begin revealing what they know about these secret programs. We really need a political revolution. It doesn't have to be violent, but it could be nonviolent, to really bring these secrets into the light of day. Because as Justice Brandeis said, sunshine is the ultimate antiseptic. We need to clean up government. And the disclosure movement is going to be an important part of this. I have a conviction that, I believe that the disclosure movement will be as significant a movement in world political history as the abolition movement was in Great Britain and the United States, emancipating people from physical slavery. I believe the disclosure movement will ultimately play the role of emancipating the people of the world from metaphysical enslavement. And that metaphysical and even situational enslavement could be brought about as the result of a tyrannical government or world government being possession of knowledge of where any of us would be at any moment in the future, for example. That would be a thoroughgoing form of surveillance that should simply not be implemented.
But and for I think not we're alarmingly close to that point.
Yes, we are. And so there's an urgency to this. This is why I'm speaking up, because as we see these harbingers of a police state being brought down around us, we need to know also what are the technologies that such a police state could be implementing to oppress us. And I'm sorry to say, it could be both teleportation and chronovision. They could use teleportation to get to locations faster than we could, and they could use chronovision to absolutely deprive us of any form of privacy. And that needs to be addressed through a new opening in government. We need to use the disclosure movement to bring these secrets into the light of day and to create amnesty for those people who are in possession of state secrets like this, to tell the people what they deserve to know, which is that quantum access was achieved 40 years ago and its positive capabilities have never been used in the life-advantaging way that they could have been from around the year 1970. And as we now find ourselves on this frightening threshold of a global police surveillance state, that we need to prevent the government from achieving this sort of total information awareness that Admiral Poindexter was appointed to achieve for the United States government under DARPA, which was, in my view, probably the most frightening development of the Bush years. So, yes, I'm speaking out as a whistleblower because I believe that people should possess basically a right that they are endowed by their creator to live in freedom and enjoy life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness without being oppressed by a tyrannical government that would wish to surveil them at any particular moment of their lives.
Do you feel more hope with the current government, with the Obama administration, that we may reach a point of disclosure of all these different technologies, or is it business as usual?
That's something that I can offer direct evidence about. I just serendipitously, as a young college student who 10 years previously had been one of the 140 American school children enrolled in Project Pegasus, I had a brief encounter with Barack Obama when I was an undergraduate at UCLA, and he had spent a year at Columbia University under the tutelage of Zbigniew Brzezinski, and was in Los Angeles visiting his friends from the first 2 years of college that he spent at Occidental College out near Eagle Rock, California. And we were introduced to each other at the West Los Angeles home of one of Barack Obama's allies in the anti-apartheid movement. And so I have a view of Barack Obama that is informed by this 30-minute discussion that we had in that individual's apartment. And I think I could say that Barack Obama at 20, I mean, he's a month older than I. We're truly contemporaries. And this was in spring-summer of 1982 time frame, so both of us had not yet turned 21. The Barack Obama that I met at age 20 was intelligent, perceptive, and articulate, and I'm not surprised at all that he reached the U.S. presidency and at such a young age. He was also a positive person, a friendly, thoughtful person, and I think he's brought a number of those more sort of warm and human qualities into his service in government. So I would like to, I'm a registered Democrat, and I would like to presume that he will do the right thing and embrace my truth campaign in some of these major areas, you know, acknowledging in the realm of natural history that Mars is inhabited and that we've already sent personnel there, working with the disclosure movement to bring some of these advanced technologies, declassify them and bring them into the public realm so that the public can understand, for example, that we can teleport between distant locations on Earth, and also work with lawyers who are aligned with the disclosure movement, such as I am, to begin to draft the legislation and initiate the truth and amnesty process that we need to declassify these secrets and perform this corrective function in our political culture. If I had to say today whether I have hope that he will or he won't, well, that's going to be governed by what I found out during that 1982 meeting with Barack Obama, and that was he had already been briefed on his presidency. One of the bizarre political concomitants of the fact that this quantum access capability emerged by 1970 is that a number of the last U.S. presidents, including Barack Obama, were given prior knowledge of their destinies as U.S. president. And that included himself, because at the end of that very voluble political discussion I had with the young Barack Obama from Columbia when I was at UCLA, was a statement made by the person who had introduced us, the person who I had gone from the UCLA campus over to his apartment in West L.A. to meet his house guest, Barack Obama, who said during the end of that discussion, "You better be nice to Barack, Andy, because he's going to be president of the United States someday." And then I said something flippant like, "Oh, well, maybe we'll pitch against each other in the World Series." And then Obama used that as an excuse to break away from what was ultimately pretty much an argument by that point in the discussion. And then his friend turned to me again and said, "No, you don't understand, Andy. We know he's going to be president of the United States." So clearly Barack Obama, during that year that he was under the tutelage of Brzezinski at Columbia, had already been informed of his destiny as president in the same way that I, both as a child and as a young adult, had a set of briefings about the fact that I would one day be identified as the discoverer of life on Mars, or at least the person who would write the first work essentially proving that Mars is an inhabited planet. This, in fact, was the first usage of the phrase person of interest. The first persons of interest weren't terrorists aligned with Al-Qaeda. They were young Americans that the intelligence community was identifying as culturally significant in the future based on what their respective destinies were. And I know to a personal certainty that both Barack Obama, as one of my contemporaries, and myself, were given the form of knowledge of our destinies. So to the extent that he was given this prior information, I mean, if I speak for myself, I'm speaking out now as a whistleblower. That's the decision I've made, to be true to the truth and to do right by the people of the world and of my own country. I hope that President Obama possesses the intelligence and the principle to also do so and embrace my truth campaign. I hope that he sees the truth campaign that I'm waging as essentially a prerequisite for the change campaign that he's called for. Because you really can't achieve change until you confront the truth. And in order to do that, we're going to have to declassify the different set of activities that the U.S. government has been up to so that we can really reform our political culture and achieve the lofty purposes that he set his presidency to. So I'm hoping he'll do the right thing, but I really don't want to prejudice his decision because it is his. In the same way that I chose to speak out and do what was right, and now I find Cliff High at the ALTA project identifying me as one of two major planetary whistleblowers that are going to come along that were predicted by ALTA. I mean, I'm very flattered by that, but I really see it as a duty that I take very seriously to be performing this form of public service. And I'm just hoping and praying that my contemporary Barack Obama will also do so, and I think that he will. So that would be my answer. But I don't know, because it really comes down to what he personally decides to do.
Well, from what you've described there, it seems to me that it was could either have been a projection of his destiny, or on the sort of downside of it, that he could be more of a Manchurian candidate. But I suppose that's something time will tell.
Time will only tell, and I think if I look at my own experience, I think it's more or less not being cultivated by the intelligence community, but just the fact that they clearly didn't want to play God and intervene and change future events. That was not only the institutional decision that had been made, that was the wide consensus among the project people that I had contact with, for example, when I was on the project as a kid. But I do know, based on that statement that was made in Barack Obama's presence, and the briefings that I received, for example, when they had me read my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, in 1971, you know, 37 years before I would write it, as a result of them retrieving it from the future and bringing it back from the future, we also know that they were clearly intervening in the lives of individuals like George W. Bush and Bill Clinton and Barack Obama and giving them prior knowledge of their presidencies, which may not have been such a bad thing. I mean, the presidency brings with it tremendous responsibility and tremendous positive potential for, you know, change, for positive change, and also substantial potential for negative development. And so it may have been very, very well the responsible thing to do to achieve survival and peace and progressive development in the nuclear age, to approach the future presence just so they could psychologically adjust to the fact that they were destined to be present. But I know that's happened, and I'm hoping that the involvement with President Obama wasn't so substantial that he's just carrying out what the permanent secret government is asking of him, rather than being the kind of free agent that I am and doing what's right in real time, notwithstanding the prior contact we had in our lives and careers with the alphabet soup, U.S. intelligence agencies. I mean, I think it ultimately comes down to personal morality, and I don't want to predict what he will decide to do, because I will just hope and pray that he does the right thing and embraces my truth campaign. I'm going to be calling on him to do so, and I want to remain optimistic that he will determine that he should do so and will do so.
Andy, jumping back a bit from the subject we've been on right now, I just want to go back to a couple of points you mentioned earlier, one of them being that you said that you felt or were aware that the government had been in contact with extraterrestrials.
Most commonly it has been. Mm-hmm.
And what are you basing that on, and how much contact do you think there is, and is it still continuing?
Well, I'm going to describe in my book the conventional contact with extraterrestrials that I had, both of a physical nature and a psychological nature. And a number of those anecdotes are quite conventional, and I don't think really add to the discourse about the extraterrestrial situation that's evolved over the last, 60 some years since Roswell, since the time, you know, the modern UFO era. But my understanding of the role they were playing in my life seemed to link to the fact that I had sort of stepped on their terrain as a result of being a human child who was periodically being placed in that quantum environment where they operate. I mean, the most advanced so-called extraterrestrials visiting us are in fact interdimensional beings who are not reaching us via spaceships, but reaching us via time shifts. So when I began to map my extraterrestrial contact experiences, I began to see that they dovetailed with my experiences on Project Pegasus. And in fact, I even researched the question of whether or not my memories of being in Project Pegasus resulted from the implantation of memories during alien contact. And I determined that that was not the case, not only because I developed whistleblower accounts that the Project Pegasus existed and it involved the research and development of time travel technologies by the U.S. government, but that I was in it as one of the American school children caught up in it. I also found an artifact that I left in New Mexico at one of the project locations with the intent to go back and dig out of the ground. So I actually left something in New Mexico that allowed me to reality test my involvement in the project when I was on it. But I must acknowledge that I had conventional ET contact experiences from early childhood, just as I've had many other types of paranormal experiences. I mean, I'm an experiencer. Well, I mean, one of the things my father witnessed when I was 3 years old, I was levitating a small group of toys about 3 feet off our rec room at our home in New Jersey. So I've had virtually every form of paranormal experience. And to be true to what I've experienced in my life, I simply have to share that fact. So I've decided not to conceal the fact that I am an experiencer of extraterrestrial contact in the same way that people have had one or several physical contacts that then result in a pattern of seemingly astral or psychological contacts that continue through their dream life and so forth as they mature. But I do have discrete information about the extraterrestrial situation as a result of that part of Project Pegasus that touched upon our interface with extraterrestrials. For one thing, there was a lecture about the extraterrestrials in the program. We were being trained for our experiences in the project. There was a lecture describing the 4 types of extraterrestrials that are contacting us frequently, namely the grays, the so-called tall grays, the reptilian slash amphibian type, and then the Nordics, the tall, attractive-looking blondes with blue eyes that are actually larger than human beings. And the team leader who was lecturing us in that material, educating us in that material, explained that some of you children have had a lot of contact with the grays. I was also tutored in a symbolic alphabet called Astarte. Now, Astarte is somewhat of a triple entendre. It is Astarte, which is to say star art. It is Astarte. It basically introduces the child to a system of mathematical logical notation that governs their thought processes in a sort of a cosmologically seamless way, sort of a cosmologically mathematically consistent way, allowing them to reason on a higher level with greater accuracy. And it was also a veiled reference to Astarte, who was the goddess of the Hermetic tradition, going all the way back to ancient Sumer, in which young people have been given specialized training in childhood to then become future leaders of human society. Because it was at ancient Sumer in 3000 BC in which civilization was essentially restarted via extraterrestrial intervention following the solar system catastrophe of 9500 BC, when that first or previous civilization on Earth had been destroyed. And then with extraterrestrial intervention in ancient Sumer around 3000 BC, this second civilization on Earth began to flourish. So this system of mathematical logical symbols was a NASA derivation of a Hermetic alphabet that was the legacy of that extraterrestrial Sumerian collaboration around the year 3000 BC that created that golden age in human civilization that was so positive that we now call the nicest season of the year summer, in a reference to Sumer and the time when civilization really began to flourish on Earth, with the introduction of mathematics and writing and agricultural science and so forth, where human beings could live a good life, you know, in the, and enjoy the summer, and the other seasons by having a quality of life and having their needs met by, you know, intelligent, collaborative, industry on the surface of the earth. So as one of the child chrononauts in Project Pegasus, I was privileged to participate in tutorials where that alphabet was inculcated in me. Initially, it was a group of about 250 symbols that I learned in a tutorial with a man by the name of Joseph Humer, who was essentially a special educator in my school district. But then later, during one of the summers in New Mexico, I then had to memorize several thousand of those symbols. And these are just basic little schematic-like symbols. For example, a circle with a dot in it represents Earth, because when you come into our solar system from outside our solar system, Earth is just a tiny little dot in front of the sun. And let's say the Hopi symbol, where you have a circle with a diameter across it and then a line going from the midpoint of the circle up to the circumference of the circle, represents civilization because you're establishing a structure on the surface of the spherical planet. So I know that the U.S. government was preparing for alien liaison and the creation of a cadre of communication officers to these extraterrestrial civilizations that they knew were beginning to visit Earth, because I was being trained in the very language that would be used to communicate with the extraterrestrials. And
yeah,
in fact,
who were you being trained by?
I was being trained, again, by special educators under DARPA who were attached to Project Pegasus. So, for example, there's a secret lab under the auxiliary gym at the Los Alamos Public High School. So in one of those summers in New Mexico, my dad and I were living in White Rock, and then, you know, we had teleported there, and we'd be teleporting at the end of the summer to the afternoon of the day we had left in New Jersey. So I had these four time loops where I took part in specialized training in New Mexico. And the focus, almost the entire focus of one of those summers was a set of training exercises in alien-human liaison. Another reason I know that we've been interacting with extraterrestrials is my father's own career in aerospace. I mean, he, after the July 1952 overflight of Washington, D.C., by nine flying saucers that had been clocked by the radar station at Langley Air Force Base at traveling in excess of 7,000 miles per hour, an event that was actually reported on the front page of the New York Times and the Washington Post in July of 1952. My dad was working for Okanite Company in Paramus, New Jersey, and a military officer, I believe it was an Army officer, actually came to his desk and ordered him to report the next Monday to Curtis Wright Aeronautical Company in Woodridge, New Jersey, where he was then attached to one of the compartmentalized divisions that was designing the ramjet for Curtis Wright. He was attached to the division that would design a metal alloy that would not melt when the ramjet planes achieved critical velocity in our atmosphere or near-Earth environment as a result of colliding with molecules of oxygen or space dust or what have you. So my dad was under tremendous stress there in the mid-50s, trying to find an alloy to allow us to create a space plane to try to chase the extraterrestrials out of our atmosphere and near-Earth environment. So my own father's career in aerospace was initiated by whatever threat potential the extraterrestrial presence had made itself evident by 1952. I also know that we've been in liaison with at least one extraterrestrial species, because when I was in New Mexico during one of those summers, my dad and several of the other project people explained that some of the extraterrestrials they were working with wanted to meet the children of our project people. And there was a meeting with me and one of the other kids with these gray-type extraterrestrials who had much larger heads and faces than the gray extraterrestrials that I had contact with during my own contact experiences. In fact, these extraterrestrials looked a lot more similar to that costume of an extraterrestrial that Arizona Governor Fife Symington did that hoax news conference with after the Phoenix Lights case of 1997. And I commend Governor Symington for being so courageous in now coming forward and revealing, in fact, that that was a very large extraterrestrial craft that was hovering above Phoenix during the Phoenix Light episode or incident. But we met with these two extraterrestrials, and they were so intelligent that my mind actually became overwhelmed, and I had to leave the meeting twice because their intelligence was causing racing thoughts in my mind.
So you physically met with what are described as grays?
Yes. The New Mexico and Southern Colorado are extensively undergirded by tunnels that are used to transport individuals and technologies and even extraterrestrial individuals to different secret locations in New Mexico and elsewhere. And this particular meeting took place in essentially a rudimentary briefing room, very rudimentary briefing room, in one of the underground tunnels in New Mexico. And they were, you know, we were coached beforehand about how to ask them basic questions like, oh, Niagara Falls and the Grand Canyon are considered very beautiful natural areas on our planet Earth. What are some of the beautiful areas on your planet? So they were actually grooming us before this meeting to ask these kinds of benign questions of the extraterrestrials, and I guess also to sort of try to derive information from them to find out more about them. Because as my dad later explained, you know, I asked him after the meeting, why did they want to meet with me? And what I was really asking was, why are the extraterrestrials in my life? And what he was answering was this regarding the specific meeting. And he said, you know, they wanted to meet with some of the children of our project people. And I said, well, what do they want? Why are they visiting our planet? And he said, nobody knows. And in fact, that was what I was told by Mr. Humer when he was training me in a start, you know, this mathematical or logical notational system that would ultimately be used for alien-human liaison or you know, off-planet diplomacy. He said that basically, by 1970, the U.S. government knew that extraterrestrials were visiting Earth, that they were contacting specific individuals who could be expected to be contacted sporadically during multiple times in their lives. They didn't know why they were contacting specific individuals, and more importantly, they didn't know who the aliens were, where they were from, or what they wanted. So actually, when I was being tutored in that alphabet so I could communicate with aliens, I was actually tasked with the duty by my government to try to figure out who they were and what they wanted and, you know, where they were from and some of these critical questions about their presence on our planet. But not only did the U.S. government know we were being visited, not only do I know from my father's own secret career in aerospace that we launched a supersonic jet project in 1952 to counter their presence in our atmosphere, but one species was actually the guests of the United States government in New Mexico.
So when you say you communicated with them, how was that? Was that through words, through thoughts? How was the communication?
We sat at the table and we asked questions, but they were answering us in unaccented English telepathically.
Mm-hmm.
So it was strange to be saying, you know, asking a question like, you know, what are the beautiful natural areas on your planet? And having the answer come back in our minds through them telepathically.
No, I just want to know, would you describe them as the classic alien gray that we're told about, which is with this large slanting eyes?
Yes, they had large Asiatic features, even far more, you know, their eyes were larger and more elliptical, and their faces far broader than, let's say, a classic Han Chinese individual. I mean you cast no aspersions like that, but their eyes do possess an epicanthic eye fold like Asian individuals possess, perhaps suggesting you know, that all of us have extraterrestrial genes of one kind or another. In fact, that's already been established by genetic engineering. So I resist the phrase alien, by the way, because these species are, I think, should be conceived of as our kin. They just happen to be from other star systems. But these are our relatives on other planets and other star systems. And they were not hostile. I could tell that they were kind, intelligent creatures. But, in fact, these two individuals, which was a man and a woman, as I mentioned previously on this show, they basically had larger heads and faces than the cuter extraterrestrials that I was having contact with during my ordinary life. They basically were the size of adult humans and had large elliptical eyes with an epicanthic eye fold, and small noses and very broad faces and tiny ears and mouths. but they had much larger heads and faces than the cute little grays that were popping up in my early childhood. And it was also explained to me that they were, you know, residing there. I know it's been alleged in some of the UFO literature that their colony is under the mountains in Santa Fe. And while I can't confirm that, I could certainly circumstantially, you know, corroborate the fact that it was in those large underground tunnels in New Mexico where that briefing took place. In fact, the tunnel underneath Los Alamos is so large, I would say it's about twice the width of the Lincoln Tunnel in New York City. It's huge. And so walking around that warren of tunnels in New Mexico, you know, in other words, we entered that underground system and were directed to a briefing room where they were then brought in, and we had basically this telepathic conversation with two of the extraterrestrials who were permanent guests of our government.
So it wasn't the case of being held captive. It was more that they were visiting or staying there of their own free will.
That was my impression. And when we were communicating with them, they were also not just cold, autonomic sort of beings like it sometimes appears in the UFO literature. For example, when I asked them whether they were male and female and whether they were husband and wife and committed to each other emotionally, the female actually laughed telepathically in a very kind of shy and demure way, in a charming way. So they possessed human traits, including emotion and devotion to each other emotionally and so forth. So it was really quite a powerful experience. I was somewhat afraid of them. And in fact, when I got up the second time as an excuse to leave the room to get some water in the hall, the female gray extraterrestrial said, Oh, Andy, don't be frightened, you know, in my mind. But it was very overwhelming just to be communicated to and telepathically in your mind. That itself was spacing me out. But they basically were about the size of adult humans. They had heads and faces that were about twice the size of an adult human. And they had long hands, but they were essentially human. And so you might look at them like you would look at a peculiar-looking human being. They weren't that foreign to my experience. And because I had contact with the smaller, cuter, gray extraterrestrials, I wasn't keenly frightened of them, but I certainly felt disconcerted being in the same room with them. I mean, it was odd and somewhat menacing, but I still didn't panic. But, I mean, you know, it was a stressful experience to be having this sort of discussion with humanoids who were non-human.
Andy, going back also to some of the earlier stuff you talked about, it led me to wonder when we hear these cases of people describing what they believe was an abduction, an alien abduction experience. Two thoughts crossed my mind while you were talking. One was that some of them could certainly or possibly be government experiments, perhaps being done similar to the Pegasus Project and the teleport transportation you were experiencing, perhaps a long-distance project where the government and or aliens were actually accessing people in their homes or their beds, however these usually occur, without actually physically abducting the person, but perhaps leaving them with that impression. Do you have any thoughts on that as being a possibility?
Well, I mean, I can corroborate the MyLab accounts to the extent that I can say that I know to a personal, a moral, you know, a scientific certainty that secret branches of the military-industrial complex in the United States were not just monitoring the extraterrestrial situation or trying to achieve air travel that would allow us to counter any possible threat from such visitors, but that indeed several different factions were in liaison with extraterrestrials. Now, when I went back and had to map what happened to me in Pegasus, I did explore whether it had been caused by either remote or abduction-related implantation by aliens. And I have absolutely discounted that because, for example, I'll just give you an example of one conversation. I interviewed Cliff Harris, who was the youngest among those distinguished climatologists who were working with Dr. Ivan Browning when he was director of science and technology for the CIA, a position that he held from 1959 to 1974. And Dr. Harris confirmed that when he was working on the CIA's Ice Age studies with other climatologists under Ivan Browning in the early 70s, Ivan Browning was talking about the project that I was describing on the phone with Dr. Harris. that teleportation had been achieved, that people were jumping back and forth across the country to New Mexico and back to their home bases, that they were undertaking trips via stargates to non-local locations in New Mexico, and then being teleported back to New Mexico and then back to their bases elsewhere in the country, and that the U.S. Defense Department was also involving children in such activities. So I was able to corroborate the historicity of my experiences through these whistleblowers and establish that my memories, while possibly colored by some alien contact experiences I had, did not emanate, causally speaking, from such experiences, but were independent, real-life experiences resulting from being an intelligent, psychically gifted child who was placed in a secret defense project at a very young age. So I can affirm the MILAB experiences in the sense that I know that the U.S. military industrial complex has been working with some species of our extraterrestrial visitors. But I don't believe that my discrete experiences were propagated by extraterrestrials. In fact, in addition to the whistleblowers, I've retrieved an artifact that I left in New Mexico. I've retrieved very mundane but highly specific corroboration of things that were said to me about local folkloric sort of events in Old Town Albuquerque and so forth, and other things that really reveal that I was in New Mexico during those years. You know, even being able to establish, you know, what somebody's nickname was or what Don Rumsfeld's favorite drink was and so forth. So although my overall sort of ontological worldview was being colored by having sort of several episodes of ET contact, I know that my experiences in Project Pegasus, almost all of which were non-extraterrestrial connected, happened in the real world and were not the result of influence by extraterrestrials or remote influence by the U.S. government. For example, prior to his death in 1990, I had a number of very calm, you know, mid-afternoon discussions with my dad where there was no, you know, I was not under the impress of any sort of selection pressure that would, skew my reality. These were just ordinary conversations you would have with your father. And we discussed the whole project. And I mean, I guess somebody cynically could say, well, maybe those discussions with your dad were propagated by extraterrestrials. But the problem is, I've corroborated what I did in Project Pegasus in highly specific ways, yet ultimately mundane investigative ways. And I really have taken it out of the ambit of causation being attributed to either extraterrestrials or to the MILAB type experiences. I do think people are being subjected to psychological abduction by extraterrestrials, and that would also suggest psychological abduction with teams, involving teams of extraterrestrials and human beings working, for example, for the U.S. military.
So and when
I mean,
you
after all, I wasn't a U.S. military project. I mean, DARPA is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. It's more militarily aligned than even the Central Intelligence Agency is.
So when you say psychological abductions, that would be as opposed to people literally physically being taken from their homes into UFOs, as most people describe experiencing. It could be more that that's part of an implant, but they were psychologically tampered with.
I think the literature shows that frequently people have one or several physical abductions, and then that most of their interaction with the extraterrestrials, or so-called extraterrestrials, I would prefer the phraseology interdimensional beings, after that point is essentially being propagated by a psychological abduction. I think that's what the experiencer phenomenon actually shows. And I think it's in that context that a number of individuals have described a pattern of psychological abduction during their lives involving military abduction. The problem is I've already proved the historicity of Project Pegasus to an historical certainty and my own involvement to an historical certainty. And almost all of it involved the development of quantum access by the U.S. government, not any future role that I might play as a communications officer to extraterrestrial civilizations. That was sort of a sidebar that was just cobbled together because they knew we were being acclimated to doing things like teleporting. And, I mean, if you're teleporting somebody, it might be to another planet, such as I experienced in the trips to Mars in 1981, or it would involve clearly the quantum access that the extraterrestrials themselves are capable of. So they synthesized the extraterrestrial liaison component of the program with all of the many and storied things we were doing in quantum access, but Project Pegasus was primarily about the development of the quantum access capability and not some kind of support function related to interacting with the extraterrestrials. I'm certain of that.
When you say also that you have had encounters with what we'll call the alien greys or the extraterrestrial greys, have you also had any personal experience that you're aware of with any of the other forms, like you mentioned the Nordics as they're described, or the smaller greys?
Well, the experiences that I had that seemed to have maybe been triggered by Project Pegasus work, but which in no way seemed to have been part of the project in the way that meeting with the two extraterrestrials in New Mexico was with the small greys. You know, having an experience where I found myself waking up in the middle of the night and then walking into the study adjacent to the bedroom where I was sleeping in our house in New Jersey and having greys standing there and so forth. So the extraterrestrial contact experiences that I've decided to share as I go about the process of sharing my experiences in Project Pegasus and related to Mars and so forth involved, I would say, maybe 5 or 6 contacts with the greys in childhood.
And all of them were pleasant experiences?
I wouldn't describe them as pleasant, but I wouldn't describe them as horrific. They were sort of stressful and sometimes exciting, sometimes intimidating, but always interesting.
And what
I don't
do
think
you,
anything hard.
What do you think or have views on the idea that, which has been thought of by many people, that they are, or some of the extraterrestrials are engaging in some kind of hybridization program with humans?
I wouldn't doubt it, because one of them told me one time when I asked them where they were from, they pointed to a specific place in the sky, in other words, out in the room we were in. It was a north by north location. And then I said, well, who are you? What are you? And he said, you're kin. And I said, what do you mean? And he explained that they were part of they were connected up the, you know, actually, well, yeah, back up the chain of evolution to more of a primordial group of humanoids from which human beings on Earth had derived. So we were essentially their descendants. But he used the phrase kin. And in fact, in one abduction, I prefer the phrase contact experience, I went into the study next to my bedroom in our house in New Jersey, and the gray who had summoned me into the room opened up our attic, and there was a group of grays of different ages and genders standing in like a family group portrait kind of semicircle. And he said, Andy, this is my family. I wanted to introduce you to them. That's what he said telepathically. So ultimately in childhood, I did not develop a fear of the grays. I mean, that meeting in New Mexico was stressful, especially since those particular extraterrestrials' faces and eyes were so big and ominous looking. But I found the grays that I interacted with almost sort of pretty. I mean, they had very, very pleasing features, not the scary features that have been depicted in a lot of the motion pictures and so forth about extraterrestrial contact. These were very benign, intelligent, peaceful beings with lithe bodies and a very graceful way of moving. And I did not find them terrifying at all. I found them quite friendly. Like the way that you would be if you were a child and you were out in a meadow and a butterfly landed on your finger or something. These were encounters with other life forms in the cosmos that I perceived both cognitively and intuitively not only meant me no harm, but meant me well.
Out of curiosity, I know you've said that you feel that, for example, the United States government, the president's presumably aware of what's going on. Do you think a lot of this is kept hidden from a president, or do they have full access to everything that's going on in these closed and secret military projects? I mean, for example, can we assume that every president, Nixon, Carter, Reagan, Bush, both the Bushes, and now Obama, is aware that we are in contact with extraterrestrials and aware of things like the Pegasus Project and time teleportation?
Well, I was speaking about the fact that I know the last 4, possibly the last 6 U.S. presidents were given an awareness of their destinies as president decades in advance so that they could psychologically prepare for destinies involving such great responsibility and importance. If I look back on my experiences on Pegasus and the fact that they had me lying to my own mother about what I was experiencing, And if I look at how information was only parceled out to me every time I had contact with, for example, the CIA, when I was being briefed about something by Courtney M. Hunt, you know, who was my contact officer to CIA, I have to presume that certainly during the period before they become president, people who reach that high office are only having things shared with them on a need-to-know basis only standard, because that was the standard that I was subjected to both when I was officially in Project Pegasus and then later. They have a way of reaching you and getting information that they think you need to know in a way that would really astound people if they knew how efficient the U.S. intelligence community is doing that, basically dropping an operative into somebody's life and then bringing them up to speed about something. I would guess, based on my understanding from the ufological literature, you know, sort of the literature of the UFO cover-up, and my own experiences in Project Pegasus, and also as somebody who's, I've tried to contribute to ufology. For example, I brought the principal trilogy about the Fatima incident of 1917 as a series of close encounters with extraterrestrials, which was written by Dr. Joaquin Fernandez and Fina D'Armada, two Portuguese historians, and other scholars. I brought that series into English. So I've tried to contribute to humanity's understanding of the extraterrestrial situation. And that was driven not only by my own interest in contact experiences, but also the experiences that I had in Project Pegasus that related to the extraterrestrial situation and which I'll be sharing in my book. And I have to conclude that the U.S. intelligence community never shares everything with anybody. It's part and parcel of the way it's constructed, the way it's architected, is to keep information compartmentalized. And so the story that President Bill Clinton told, that when he became president, he asked the CIA who shot President Kennedy and are we being visited by extraterrestrials, and he didn't receive answers that satisfied him. And that's when he presumably tasked the attorney John Podesta to begin exploring these issues in deep politics, because he, after all, had reached the presidency. And we also see this emphasis in the MJ-12 literature, that the president himself is not always, or ultimately it will be herself, is not always granted access to the NATO cosmic top secret, you know, above top secret information. I think that's probably what has been going on. Even the president of the United States, whoever it is at a certain time, is not given access to all of the above top secret material. They're only given access when they need to know the information. Which means the presidency of the United States has not only been debased in terms of the people who reached the presidency having prior knowledge of their destinies as president, which was never within the contemplation of the framers of the U.S. Constitution. We're sure of that. And also being debased by the president not having total information awareness, such as President George W. Bush tasked Admiral Poindexter to achieve at DARPA. One really wonders whether government itself has been usurped by the cult of intelligence. And that's another concern that I have that's causing me to speak out. That's not what the framers of the U.S. Constitution intended. It shouldn't be going on in other advanced societies as well. And if the president or other national executives and chief executives in other countries don't have access to what their governments know, how are we going to prevent a certain faction within a country from completely enslaving the entire population or woefully oppressing it in terms of its access to future information, taking commercial advantage of future information gathered via quantum access, going into independent one-off treaties between private corporations and extraterrestrial civilizations? These are all threats to the public sphere and to the public and form of government that we should be serving the global public that we have to address when we think about whether, in fact, you know, the President of the United States is even allowed to know everything that the U.S. government knows. It's a very serious issue.
You know, if it wasn't so potentially frightening and dangerous, it's almost farcical, the situation you describe of so many departments scampering around with their secrets and hiding stuff from each other. And it's just like an endless cycle of drama and intrigue and just spinning aimlessly around, basically.
And Emily, we see that comic opera in the fact that around the time that Courtney Ann Hunt was basically place in my life in 1981 to both investigate me and also train me for the jumps to Mars. It was clear that the CIA didn't know entirely what the truth was. And yet, look at the situation. My dad was literally the dollar-a-year man on teleportation between the principal engineering company involved, which is the Ralph M. Parsons Company. In fact, when Ralph M. Parsons bought the largest civilian yacht in the world, which had previously been owned by the Iranian arms merchant Adnan Khashoggi, the ship was not called the Pegasus, and Ralph M. Parsons had never owned anything called Pegasus, but he renamed, you know, rechristened the ship Pegasus II. And that's, until very recently, I think it might even still be on the Parsons Corporation website pertaining to the biography of the founder of Parsons, Ralph M. Parsons, who was one of the two lieutenants to Stephen Bechtel during World War II, the other being John A. McCone, who became CIA director. But we have a situation there in the part of my story in the early 80s where, you know, Courtney M. Hunt enters my life. I'm reporting for the UCLA Daily Bruin while also they're engaging in social disruption campaigns against me, I presume, because actually this helps answer a previous question that you asked. They were, I think, interfering in my life because they were afraid that I would publish something about Pegasus on the pages of the UCLA Daily Bruin. Because I've done a feature piece about the experiences of one of the atomic veterans at Yucca Flat in Nevada during the 1950s, a kind of a feature news piece, sort of a slice of life kind of op-ed piece in which I was describing what happened to this particular atomic veteran to just draw public attention to this whole class of U.S. veterans who had been irradiated, even having conditioned black come over them where they were actually breathing radioactive dust and, you know, developing lung cancer and so forth after a number of years. So I think they were afraid that I was going to spill the beans about Project Pegasus when I was writing for the Daily Bruin, and I was having all manner of weird things going on, surreptitious druggings, abductions, intimidation, bizarre infiltrations in my social life that I've documented thoroughly. I mean, the very person who was my roommate during my third year of college at UCLA was never enrolled at UCLA. I verified that through the UCLA Registrar's Office. Somebody with that name and date of birth has never been enrolled at UCLA. Okay, so those are the kinds of social disruptions that I was describing. But the truth of the situation is relative to the history of the U.S. intelligence community that only 10 years after I had my experiences in Project Pegasus, the CIA itself was investigating me because the institutional CIA didn't know exactly what I had been involved in, but clearly had my name on some project files that it had tasked a team of CIA people to go and perform a field investigation to figure out who I was and what I had actually been involved in. And yet my own father was, had been a technical consultant to the Navy, the Air Force, the CIA, and other U.S. agencies for decades. So that's how I'm highly compartmentalized the situation is. The CIA sometimes has to investigate itself to figure out what it itself has done. And that causes me to be reminded of a line from a poem by W.B. Yeats, you know, the falconer cannot see the falcon. I mean, there are times when the whole function of the intelligence community itself is lost and they need to investigate themselves just to figure out what they've done.
Right.
That's how extensive and how deeply compartmentalized this post-war military-industrial intelligence complex now is. And I believe that certainly the Republican constitutional form of government has clearly been undermined in the way that such a perceptive critic as, let's say, the author Gore Vidal has described. It was really the emergence of the intelligence community that ended constitutional government in the United States. And that's, again, one of the reasons that I'm speaking out.
Andrew, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. As a closing note, do you have anything that you would like to say? And also, is there a website, perhaps, for the Mars Anomaly Research Society, or a way that people can perhaps read more of your research? I know you have a book coming up. When is that due to be published?
I hope to complete it this year. I support myself as an attorney in private practice, and I have some potentially lucrative cases right now and also several large transactions that I'm trying to broker, basically to earn enough money to essentially go on a hiatus in my law practice for a year and complete the book, or maybe even 6 months and I can complete it. So I hope to have the book out by next summer, certainly by this time next year. I have all the material. I don't have to do any more research. There's really three points I want to make, well, really in prescript before making those points. One is that I'm really operating on two footings right now. The first is the effort that I'm doing in natural history to prove simply that Mars is inhabited. And I don't care whether my more controversial claim that Mars has been visited by U.S. personnel via teleportation and that in 1981 I became one of those teleportees is ever proved to an historical certainty. I simply don't care. But what I care very deeply about is the fact that the planet that every 2 years comes closest to Earth is inhabited. It is inhabited by humanoid beings that both closely resemble us because they're our genetic cousins that we were separated from by the solar system catastrophe of 9500 BC when debris elements from the Vela supernova explosion came into our solar system and essentially ended, or at least profoundly impeded, the civilization on Mars and on Earth. That was the great maritime civilization on Earth that built the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx. So I care about the fact that Mars has several types of humanoid species. Different animal species that presently exist, have never existed, or are some hybrid of a living Earth species, or that are Earth species that are now extinct on Earth but still survive on Mars. And I also recognize, as somebody devoted to the overall cause of environmental law and policy on an international basis, that there are extremely precious ancient artifacts on Mars that we need to understand and interpret to understand the true history of our own solar system. And I would refer your listeners to Graham Hancock's excellent book, The Mars Mystery, to describe how vital it is that we need to understand the nature of those Egyptian-linked ruins on planet Mars and what they tell us about the history of our own solar system. Now, because Mars is inhabited, and even to save Earth, we're going to have to extend the ambit of environmental protection on an international basis to include an intergalactic basis. That is to say, we need to bring other celestial bodies in our solar system under the umbrella of environmental protection that we're now trying to establish on planet Earth. That means that Mars, as an inhabited planet, environmentally speaking, needs to be protected from visitation, exploration, habitation, and possible colonization by Earthlings. I'm disturbed that as distinguished a space scientist as astronaut Buzz Aldrin, literally one of my heroes as one of the, you know, early astronauts, and somebody who actually derived the mathematical model that allowed us to land successfully on the moon with conventional craft, has called for the colonization of Mars. That cannot occur if we were to do the right thing, because Mars is an inhabited planet, and Mars does not belong to us. Mars belongs to the Martians, not only the Martian humanoids, but the other life forms there that we don't know necessarily are not sentient, highly intelligent beings just because they look like animals or some combination of animals that we find on Earth. Some of those animals on Earth may be very intelligent, sentient beings. I know that while there are statues up there, some of them are, in fact, life forms because some of the photographs capture them moving. And you see both a blur from where they were when the picture was starting to be taken and then a more congealed image of them when the photograph is finally, or the photo mosaic is finally resolved. And so I'm speaking out about Mars primarily because I want to promote the enactment of a Mars Protectorate Treaty under the United Nations. And that effort would be led by international lawyers who would be nominated by all of the principal spacefaring nations and groups of nations, to include the United States, Russia, Japan, China, India, and the European Union. I hope I didn't leave anybody out. But basically, the major spacefaring nations need to take stock of the fact that Mars is inhabited. And before we travel there more extensively, whether it's via teleportation under the CIA DARPA faction in the United States, or whether it's via conventional propulsion under the NASA faction in the United States, as other nations also join the United States in visiting Mars, such as the U.S. Mars, the U.S.-Russia Mars mission that has been spoken of, and also the Russian-Chinese mission that has been articulated, we need to have an international treaty established to protect Mars from ourselves. because while it's part of our environment, it's part of the rest of the cosmos, it has already been settled and is the habitation of humanoid life forms like us. And we should apply the golden rule to the inhabitants of other planets. We should do by the inhabitants of other planets what we would wish they would do towards us as inhabitants of this beautiful planet, planet Earth, which is unspeakably precious when you consider its natural bounty. And so I'm concerned that we start discussing this subject so that that treaty is evolved. And my distinguished colleague, Alfred Lambert Weber, one of our leading space lawyers and the founder of exopolitics as a social science discipline, I believe will be one of the principal architects of that treaty. Okay, so that's why I'm speaking out about Mars. In terms of my revelations about my experiences in Project Pegasus, there's really two objectives that I hope to achieve. One is, I hope that in the telling of my experiences, everybody who hears my account will learn and see that teleportation was achieved 40 years ago and then kept secret by the U.S. government, and therefore we haven't been able to use it to modernize our transportation infrastructure as we may literally need to modernize it during the 21st century to stem global warming and survive as a planetary civilization. If we don't get a handle on greenhouse emissions, we could have a mass flooding event that would inundate the cities in which 70% of humanity resides. And that would be a mass disaster. Even if that didn't pitch us into a new ice age, that would be a mass disaster that would take centuries to recover from. We would be living in a water world rather than, you know, this beautiful planet Earth that we enjoy today. And all these beautiful cities around the world and all of the potential that hold as human habitation would be crippled by flooding and possibly buried by massive deposits of snow and ice if we then were pitched into an ice age scenario, as was articulated so brilliantly by Art Bell and Ridley Strieber in their book, The Coming Global Superstorm. Either scenario could occur. It would probably occur based on what season of the year it was when the mass flooding event occurred. We want to prevent that event from occurring, and in order to do so, we need to rethink our transportation and industrial infrastructure and make it non-polluting. Certainly the transportation part of that new infrastructure for the 21st century would include teleportation rather than conventional transit by planes, trains, and automobiles whenever possible. And also we would have to endeavor to make it safe, both in terms of not producing biological side effects from teleportation and just simply making it safe as a form of transit. And then the other thing I'm concerned about and that my truth campaign is going to be focusing on is the fact that 40 years ago, working with a device originally invented by these two Vatican scientists, Arnetti and Gemelli, the U.S. achieved the ability to tune in an event occurring somewhere in the past or future, basically in another timeline that is non-local to the percipients who are using the device, basically a form of technical or virtual remote viewing that allows them to capture moving holographic images of past and future events. And I'm concerned that we utilize that technology in terms of its positive capability by using it to inspire people about what the past has held. And for that matter, maybe we could have scenes of the future where they'd say, well, this is what a sustainable city in 2100 will look like. That also may be a way to get there. Okay. And then I'm also eager that we, in terms of our protecting our civil liberties, we alert the public that this form of surveillance is now not only technically possible, it's already been reduced to practice, and it was reduced to practice 40 years ago. So we want to get control of government again and make sure that government doesn't continue to evolve as a conspiracy of some against the many. We want to basically re-democratize the national governments of the world, as well as the super governments embodied in organizations like the UN and other international agencies, because we are at danger of being enslaved in a police state that is in the possession of advanced quantum access technology that it can use to surveil everything we do. And so we're going to have a truth and amnesty process whereby individuals like myself who have served in some way in the military or intelligence community or both will be allowed to step forward and without fear or favor, without fear of being retaliated against by being assassinated or subjected to character assassination, which is one of the things that thus far has happened to me, that they be permitted to come forward and tell the people the truth. Because you can't achieve positive change in the life of an individual or a family or a society or indeed the world until you confront the truth. And that's what my campaign is about, and I'm happy to say that I'm now getting help and encouragement from people all over the world, and that's why I consider the role that I'm playing as a planetary whistleblower as a great cosmic privilege. And so I'll just continue to do that, and hopefully the campaign will win, and our children will be living in a world that's sustainable because they've had the very best technology that society has yet evolved available to them, which I believe, just as they have a cosmic right, a natural right to know the true history of our own solar system, and, for example, the fact that Mars is an inhabited planet just as Earth is inhabited, I also believe that living and future generations have a right to know what the best available technologies are and have the opportunity to use them to advantage humanity. And so that's what my campaign's about, and, you know, I'm happy to report that I'm really starting to get major help from my fellow human beings.
Well, thank you, Andrew, so much for talking to us today, and hopefully, as you have said, we can change the course that we're on and perhaps choose the positive and constructive options that do lie open for us rather than continuing down this path of destruction. And I hope we can stay in touch and perhaps talk again at some point in the future.
I hope we can. I look forward to that. And thank you for having me on.
You're welcome. Thanks, Andy.